Gaddis, page 82, section 9, second paragraph. One might be that it would have been too dangerous to fight over more important objects of contention like Germany, East Europe, or Japan. Important objects of oopsie. There is something to be said for this argument when one considers the precariousness with which Soviet conventional military superiority balanced the nuclear superiority of the United States during the early post-war era. Both great powers worried about how easily they might slide into a devastating conflict neither could be certain of winning. War broke out, this logic would suggest, only where vital interests were not at stake and where there could be some assurance of limiting the resulting violence. But this explanation assumes control and calculation. What is immediately apparent when one reviews what happened in East Asia between 1945 and 1950 is how little control over events officials in Washington and Moscow actually had, and how uncalculatingly, which is to say, how emotionally, they responded to the surprises they encountered in that part of the world. In a pattern familiar with the history of empires, developments on the periphery of the Cold War unexpectedly affected its center. It is worth specifying more precisely just how this happened. First, there was the tendency to assume that if one side withdrew, the other would seek to exploit the opening thereby created. The post-1945 division of Korea grew out of such reasoning. So, too, did the Americans tilt towards Chiang Kai-shek at the time of the Marshall Mission. The first in a series of decisions that embittered Mao at the cost of maintaining a presence in Asia became apparent to both superpowers. Fears of withdrawal gradually diminished. The United States began to reconcile itself to a Chinese communist victory, and both sides managed disengagement from Korea. But by then, other processes were at work that would be difficult to reverse. One of these was the way ideology distorted reality. Mao, from 1946 and on, was so convinced of Americans' ill will that he tilted towards Moscow to protect his revolution from a plot to throttle that it never existed. Stalin, surprised and pleased by the Chinese communist successes, but still wary of the ultimate intentions, had little choice but to embrace such powerful allies and to form a military and economic alliance with them. There was never an international communist monolith controlled from Moscow, but there was a common sense of ideological euphoria, a conviction that the forces of history were on their side, which was very much influenced the actions in late 1949 and early 50, not only of Stalin and Mao, but also of Ho Chi Minh and Kim Il-sung. That ideological euphoria, in turn, diminished the caution that had shaped Stalin's previous behavior towards the United States. He thus allowed Kim Il-sung to talk him into something he had earlier refused to do, authorizing an effort to reunify the Korean Peninsula by military means. Mao, more skeptical, went along because of his own designs on Taiwan. But when the North Koreans began to lose, he too threw caution to the winds and confronted the Americans, convinced that ideological zeal would ensure success. The Americans themselves, through all of this, had acted ambiguously, if not incautiously. They sent unclear signals in the way they handled the Marshall Mission and the defensive perimeter strategy. These fed Mao's suspicions in the first instance and Stalin's opportunism in the second. Once the Truman administration made the decision to defeat South Korea and to patrol the Taiwan Strait through a Sino-American military clash may have been unavoidable. One of the surprises that emerges from the new documents is Mao's eagerness to resist the Americans, apart from his momentary bout with bad days and sleepless nights during the first half of October of 1950, is for no other reason than to demonstrate that the Chinese people had at last stood up against the imperialists. This was, on his part, a major miscalculation, for not only had Mao exaggerated the Truman administration's hostility to the revolution he had made, he also underestimated the threat to China's independence that would come in time from the country he had invited to expand its influence there, the Soviet Union. There is no little irony in the fact that by the end of his life, Mao had found it necessary to invite the Americans back into China to counterbalance the Russians, even to the point of welcoming personally to Beijing in 1972 Richard Nixon, the American politician whose career had most benefited in the 1950s from condemning Red China and all its works. The chairman was not farsighted in all things.